It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we meet the composer of some of public radio's most famous theme songs and find out about his new album.
First, St. Norbert College has released its latest Wisconsin survey. The college surveyed more than 300 Wisconsinites and found out that they largely disapprove of President Trump and are evenly divided when it comes to Governor Scott Walker.
But the survey also took a look at other social issues, such as opinions on vaccines, the media, and more.
Wendy Scattergood joins us now to talk about the results. She's an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College and associate of the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. Wendy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with what Wisconsin thinks of President Trump. What did you see big picture on the approval ratings?
His approval ratings for everybody was 39%, but it's very, very polarized. Mm-hmm. Amongst Republicans, 90% approval rating, but amongst Democrats, it's 8%. And then even amongst Trump voters, it was 98% approval rating.
And how normal is that? Do we usually see this kind of partisan divide, or have we been seeing more and more of this?
We've been seeing more and more of it over the course of the surveys over the last many years, that we've been seeing just an increase in the amount of polarization between the parties. And so it's not necessarily that this administration is, you know, outside of that realm. It's just as part of that trend, it's definitely getting bigger. But his overall approval ratings are lower than, for example, when we saw Barack Obama at this time a little bit earlier, about a month earlier, when we polled for him in 2008, he was at 60% approval.
And timing, there are things happening every day. This all happened before the firing of FBI Director James Comey. What kind of events were going on just before this that you think might have swayed the approval rating one way or another?
So there was the health care being passed in the House. That certainly was part of it. But also the hearings were going on with Comey, and in fact, we asked a little bit about that, both the wiretapping potential and Russia, to see what people thought about that. So all of those things were kind of continuing on. There wasn't any one particularly big, huge news. As you say, the firing probably would have made a big difference, but we were out of the field actually just before that happened.
You also asked about how President Trump was performing on various issues. What kind of thing struck you from the results there?
I guess what struck me was that the kind of his lowest approval rating was for the environment. I guess I wasn't expecting that to kind of come up that way. And 27% approval rating on the environment. His highest approval rating was on the economy, 42%, followed by Syria at 41%. And, of course, the bombing had happened already at that point before we were in the field.
So. Before we dig some more into issues that you polled on, I wanted to ask about Governor Walker's approval rating. What did
so
you
he
see?
He has an approval rating of 49%, and it's just slightly higher, well within error margins, from what we polled in fall of 16, which was 45%. So he's been pretty steady all the way through his administration. Typically what we see for executives, governors, and presidents is that they kind of have this cycle of approval where they start really high in their first term, and then kind of dips into the third year and into the fourth year, and then it kind of blips up a little bit. And then if they have a second term, it's that same cycle, but it's a little bit lower than the first term. And he really hasn't had that. He's been actually pretty stable throughout. It's a little bit lower. I think the highest that we have him is the spring of 14 at 49%. I mean, sorry, 59%. So he's definitely higher there. And I think the lowest we have is 38% in the fall of 11. So, I mean, relative to, you know, other people in that position, that's actually pretty stable.
And do we see this similar sort of partisan divide in approval ratings for the governor?
Yeah, we do. Although it's not as polarized as some of the others. Amongst Republicans, he has an 88% approval rating, and amongst Democrats, it's 22%. So remember, for the president, it was 8% among Democrats, and it's 22% for Governor Walker. So it's a little bit higher, not quite as polarized. Independents have an approval rating for Governor Walker of 32%.
We're talking to Wendy Scattergood from St. Norbert College about the newly released Wisconsin survey. And Wendy, you did something interesting in this one. You put out different theories about events going on in the country. This is, again, at the national level for the most part, and got whether people thought they were true or not. What were some of the things that struck you? What kind of things did you ask about?
So we asked about whether people thought it was true or not that President Obama ordered a wiretap of President Trump, and only 4% think that's definitely true, but with probably true, 33% think that there might be some credence to that, versus the Russian government tampering with the election, 60% think that's either definitely or probably true. We also asked about vaccines. You know, that was not what people expect me to ask, but I know there's been stuff in the news and locally even about people not using vaccines, so I thought I would ask about that. And so I asked whether they thought the vaccine industry purposely misrepresented or hid data about the safety of vaccines, and 51% think that that's either definitely or probably true.
That's an interesting one, and I wonder, you also later in the survey asked about trust in institutions. How much of that that vaccine one do you think is people worried about vaccines in particular, and how much of it is people not trusting any industry group?
Yeah. Well, that's certainly true. And one of the things I did ask in the trust was about medical doctors, and so when I did a cross-tab of those two variables together, there's definitely a correlation that those who don't trust medical doctors also are more likely to believe that vaccine data has been misrepresented.
Yeah, and let's stick with that trust in institutions. You asked about different groups. I think doctors came out the best among the groups you asked about. The media came out the worst, and various political institutions in between. By and large, people aren't trusting a lot of people, are they?
No, they really aren't. The local government actually came out pretty well, actually, of when we combine trust them all of the time or most of the time to do what's right or do the right thing, we're looking at 61% think that local government does the right thing all or most of the time, and that was by far the highest, although medical doctors, as you say, was about 76%. And then scientists was pretty low, actually. 58% think that scientists do the right thing most or all of the time. But mainstream media, not so much, 24%. So it's quite a bit lower than the others, although neck and neck with the federal government at 23% of people said that the federal government does the right thing all or most of the time.
Is that one you've been tracking over time, this sort of trust in institutions question?
We've only been doing the trust in state and national government. We haven't done the other ones that are listed there. So we haven't done the mainstream media, and we haven't done the scientists and the doctors and stuff. I just added those for this particular survey.
You mentioned President Trump's rating on the environment, and you also had questions about climate change, whether people believe it's real, believe it's human-made, and it seems like there's been movement on those questions over time. What are you seeing change?
We've been seeing a trend, particularly among Republicans, as thinking more that it's a more serious problem and that it's happening right now, and that more of a belief that there are human causes, although a lot of that is still that they think it's both. But not only 8% of the people say that climate change is not occurring. So we're seeing some pretty big increases in that. And then we also asked a question about how certain they think the science is about that, and very high numbers with somewhat and very certain.
And then finally, I wanted to ask what we're worried about. You laid out a bunch of risks and issues out there and asked people how worried they were. What worried us the most?
Well, I guess what surprised me was how high they all were, frankly. I just was curious. I had no idea how much people were really worrying about these things. But the highest was 63% say that they worry a lot about another school shooting like Virginia Tech or Sandy Hook. San Bernardino. So that was the highest at 63%, saying they worry a lot about that. Coming next was the political climate in the United States. 57% of people think that they worry a lot about that.
And one question you asked about that seemed to have a big partisan split was the worry that the country is moving away from traditional values. What did you see there?
So overall, we saw that 53% of people worry a lot that the country is moving away from traditional values. And amongst Republicans, that's 80% worry about that a lot, compared to Democrats at 38% and independents at 37%. So there's, yeah, as you say, a very big difference there.
Wendy, thanks a lot for sharing the survey with us.
Sure.
Wendy Scattergood is an assistant professor of political science at St. Norbert College and associate of the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. She joined us today to talk about St. Norbert's most recent Wisconsin survey. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, body fat may be the least understood of our organs. We'll learn more about it and how we can keep it in check in a bit.
First, public radio fans have no doubt heard the name B.J. Lederman a time or two. The phrase composed by B.J. Lederman is likely heard during the credits of your favorite national public radio show. This is the guy who wrote the themes for Morning Edition, Weekend Edition, Marketplace, Science Friday, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and Stump the Chumps theme from Car Talk.
Now public radio's number one music guy is doing something different. This month, after decades of composing some of the catchiest radio themes ever written, B.J. Lederman has released his debut album. It's called B.J., and we just heard a song, Waterside.
B.J. joins us now to talk more about his new album. B.J., thanks a lot for joining us today.
That was a catchy tune. I kind of like that as intro music.
You like that, huh?
I'm going to mix the whole album without vocals so you guys can just, you know, talk over it.
Yeah, it's our new Central Time theme. I think that would almost work, yeah.
You can use it. How you guys doing?
Really
good.
Good
to be in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and you've been at this music thing for a while. You wrote that Morning Edition theme in 1979. All of a sudden, you want to be a rock star. What happened?
No, it's not all of a sudden. Actually, most people don't know. It's actually the other way around.
Ah.
I've always been a rock and roll guy ever since the Beatles came on, you know, and been playing in bands, doing cover tunes. And I started writing my own original songs while I was with some of these bands. But it never really entered my head, you know, that to go into a studio and cut an album in my 20s or 30s. And in the meantime, the public radio themes were kind of making a name, you know, for me behind my back. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, you need a 2.0 Hail Mary pass to a rock and roll career. If you're ever going to get it done now.
So what was it like taking that leap? I mean, you're already out there. You're famous, you know, to a degree. People know your music and a lot of it. So what was it like doing something that was just for you, just purely about the music and not about attaching it to any public radio show?
In one word, scary. Hmm. It's the scariest thing I've ever done in my life, which, you know, I've been talking about it for 30 years and have actually been at the recording of it for the past 5 years since I moved to Asheville, North Carolina. And the idea of, okay, so people, millions of people hear the theme music and they know me for that. And I get a lot of mail from people saying it's the soundtrack of my life and that kind of thing. But now it's like, okay, I'm rock and roll. It's pop and rock and roll. If you grew up with the Beatles or Billy Joel, Elton John, Steely Dan, that kind of thing. You'll hear those influences in this album, which is not called Natural Public Lederman, by the way, anymore. It's just called B.J. It's a bit of maturing on my part, I think, a bit of stepping away from the connection, you know, in most people's minds about B.J. and NPR, because it's me. It's so varied. I mean, there's so many different kinds of songs on this album because some of them were written more than two decades ago and some of them were written as soon as a year or two ago. But it's a nice roller coaster ride.
Let's talk about the Beatles a little bit. Obviously, the Beatles were a formative influence for a lot of people in the 60s and then subsequent generations. It sounds like it was more than that to you. You really were into the Beatles as a listener and as a musician.
Well, you know, John, it was life changing for me. You know, we were just we had the Beatle haircuts, and we'd talk like this when we went to school, you know, ever since we saw them on Ed Sullivan Show. So, you know, from that moment on, and when my father brought home Meet the Beatles from the store that he worked at in Virginia Beach, I collected my mom's pots and pans and pan tops and hung them from my lamp posts in my bedroom. And I had basically I put together a cardboard box drum set with mom's pot tops for cymbals. And I would play this album and go nuts. And from that moment on, I think that was probably the worst decision my parents ever made, because I was no longer headed for a career in medicine or law. Tell you that.
Well, so you wanted to be a rock star from a young age. You were obsessed with the Beatles. So how does a nice guy like you end up at NPR?
Nice guy like me. That's very kind of you.
A rock star
in the right place at the right time. With the right, you know, with a batch of chords and a good melody. I was going to American University, taking broadcast journalism from Ed Bliss, who, by the way, wrote the book, the textbook on broadcast journalism. And if any of you remember, are old enough to remember seeing Walter Cronkite look up at the camera, take his glasses off, and tell the nation that President Kennedy had died, Ed Bliss could be seen off in the far left corner, furiously typing away. He was the grandfather of broadcast journalism. But I wasn't doing too well at school. And I don't remember the question.
Oh, yeah. How'd you end up at NPR with these rock star aspirations? I think we're getting there.
We're getting there. Well, you know, I never really wanted to be a rock star. I just never wanted to be a rock star. But while I was at AU, a close friend of mine, Skip Peasy, who was in the engineering department at NPR, I had given him a cassette tape of my jingles. Yes, I used to write jingles for car companies and dairies and all kinds of stuff. And he gave it to Jim Russell, who was the first producer of this yet-to-be-named morning news show. And they really needed something quick, so I had a meeting with Jim, and it was spring break. And I went home and banged this morning edition tune out on my mother's piano and went to my guitar player friend's studio and recorded a four-track demo of it on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, mixed it down to a cassette, gave it back to Skip. He gave it to Jim, and they loved it. And the interesting thing is, Jim Russell left the show before it went on the air to go on to other things like creating Marketplace, and handed it over to the next producer, the first on-air producer, Jay Kernis, and said, you know, this is Lederman's demo. We like the theme, you know, let's use it. And that's why you're talking to me right there, that handoff.
We're talking to B.J. Lederman. He composed many of the songs you know from a lot of your favorite NPR shows. He has a new album out now of non-NPR theme music. Let's check out some more now. Let's check out a track called Sometimes. Here's a listen.
Sometimes I think of all the times I think about the times I'm thinking about nothing else but you. You know, it seems so very hard to go about my busy day, but I've got nothing else to do.
Sometimes there by B.J. Lederman. And B.J., do you work around the piano? Do you build songs around the piano for the most part?
Yeah, every now and then they pop into my head when I'm not around the piano. And I, you know, will usually pop up a recording app on my iPhone and hum something into it, or I'll get an idea for a lyric or two, and I'll just, you know, write it down in an email to myself. In the old days when I was driving and that happened, I had to actually call my home voicemail machine and sing and hum stuff into that. But mostly, yeah, it's around the piano. I'll sit there. I'll just be noodling around, and something will come up. Usually it starts with a rhythm, a bunch of chords. Not a melody right away. So I'll start. I'm sort of like Ringo of the piano. So it's just your basic chords and bass and a groove, since I'm a drummer. And then I'll start humming or singing to it. And then I'll try to figure out what it's about lyrically.
Yeah, that's something really cool listening to these tracks, is that we get to hear your voice, your singing voice. And we don't get to hear those on most of those.
Scare the children, Veronica. I don't know which.
Your voice is great. It makes me feel like NPR could have been using your voice all these years in their theme songs. What is it like to add the singing to these songs?
It's also scary. I mean, I've been singing in these bands all my life, but I've been singing things like, you know, Lady Madonna and Veronica. We actually played that song. Sorry, Rob, I can't sing
you. You don't have a Rob song. That's okay.
Yeah, it's all right. Or maybe Dr. Robert. I could have sung that.
I got to ask.
Let me just finish this. Sure. It's refreshing to finally be able to find all my different voices. You'll hear hints of Billy Joel in there. You'll definitely hear John Lennon in there. A song about my dog, actually, from Maisie's point of view, called Maisie's Song, is kind of Frank Zappa-like. You know, my name is Maisie, and I'm BJ's dog. It's very cool.
I want to get in at least one more track here. This one's Walking Down the Street.
The song Walking Down the Street by B.J. Lederman from his new album. And B.J., I want to ask you as we start to wrap up here. You know, sometimes when we know a musician for one thing that they do, when they do something new, the fans don't always like it. I'm thinking about, for instance, Bob Dylan going electric. They just want him to do what he did. Do you feel any pressure like that? No, you know, B.J., just write those nice theme songs. Or your fans, do they want to embrace this and hear this new stuff?
Well, I'm sure it's going to be something like that. Some people are going to love it, and some people are going to go, what the hell is this? And I'm sure that those people are going to, next time they hear Morning Edition or Weekend Edition, they're going to think of it a lot differently. But hopefully you'll get to see both sides of me come together as I tour the country and come to public radio stations such as yours and do concerts solo and with my band and with orchestras. I play the theme medley of all my themes with orchestras as I go around.
Cool.
We'll leave it.
In any event, you know, BJ is the first stage to the new BJ Lederman, and I hope you enjoy it. It's available now.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to BJ Lederman, composer of a lot of NPR songs. His new album is called BJ.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest looks at where human rights issues stand in the new Trump administration.
First, the words body fat can stir up a lot of complex emotions when it's mentioned. Body fat holds a special place at the intersection of health, medicine, beauty, and aesthetics. Many people throughout their lifetime will embark on a journey to banish fat from their bodies, and weight loss is a $60 billion industry.
But our next guest says that body fat's bad reputation can be chalked up to its role in our health being misunderstood, and that we can coexist with fat, even lose it, if and when we understand it.
Sylvia Tara joins us now. She's a biochemist and the author of the book, The Secret Life of Fat, the science behind the body's least understood organ and what it means for you. Sylvia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, starting with this term body fat, it's not that simple. What exactly is body fat?
So body fat is much more than what we think it is. A lot of people see it as just a reserve of calories, as something to be gotten rid of at all costs. But in truth, body fat is actually an organ, so it's much like your skin. Even a piece of skin is considered a tissue, but skin in its totality is considered an organ. And body fat is the same. It actually releases critical hormones that our body depends on. And when people don't have enough fat or they have a genetic defect in the fat, they get a multitude of health problems. So we really need to understand our fat, why it's really there for all the reasons, and respect it and treat it as well and take care of it like you would your heart or your colon or lungs or any other organ.
Well, I think in our culture, there is sort of this holy grail of having a very low percentage of body fat, and that's these days is kind of the ideal. You're saying body fat can be good. It does serve these purposes. So how exactly should we be thinking about what body fat is good and helpful and healthy, and what body fat might not be so great for us?
Sure. So body fat, you know, at normal levels really does serve us well. You know, as I said, it's an organ. It releases a number of hormones that we depend on. In fact, our body fat is linked to a healthy reproductive system. When women get too low of a body fat, so women with eating disorders say, they actually have trouble reproducing. Our brain size and brain health is also linked to a healthy amount of fat, as is our immune system and bone health. So fat is actually implicated in many, many body functions, and that is because of the hormones that it releases into our bloodstream that actually start interacting with other parts of our body as well. So, for example, one of those hormones is leptin. Leptin is released by fat cells, and leptin is released into our bloodstream, and it travels to our brain where it signals satiation. It also has effect on our metabolism. So when we lose body fat, say by dieting or even by liposuction, we have less leptin. And when we have less leptin, we actually have a higher drive to eat. We're less satiated overall. Our metabolism also gets a little bit lower, and we get a little bit more obsessive with food. And in this interesting way, fat protects itself. So when we lose it, you get a little hungrier, your metabolism gets lower. It's as if your body's making this coordinated effort to put fat back on. And that is because fat is important for all the reasons we just talked about, because its effect on our reproduction, on our brain, our immune system. So although you might really want to lose fat, your body really doesn't. And it's just something to think about, you know, as you are dieting and trying to lose it, your body will fight that effort as much as it can. And it takes longer to lose fat than you might think. And it's a harder effort than you might think. In fact, people who have lost fat have to eat about 22% fewer calories than people who are at that natural weight to begin with. So say somebody's at 150 pounds naturally, never had to diet to get to that level. When you compare them to someone who was 170 pounds, but lost 20 pounds to get to 150, the person who's lost the 20 pounds to get to 150 actually has to eat about 22% fewer calories. And again, that's because fat through leptin will reduce your metabolism after you lose fat and have lower levels of leptin.
You know, first of all, it seems like in today's world, that's not fair. I mean, this is what we read about in The Biggest Loser Science. It was an article in the New York Times, I'm sure you saw it, about how some of the people on that show who had lost a lot of weight, they were not able to eat even what they were able to eat before to maintain a weight. They had to eat far below. So what is behind that mechanism? Is there anything that people can do about it?
Yeah, the real thing to do about it is that you just have to persist. You know, this is the way our body is. Our body values fat. When we start to lose it, it tries to protect it and get it back. And so if you really want to win on your diet, number one is you have to be aware of this. And this is one reason why weight regain is so common. People aren't aware of this. And when they go on a diet, they want to eat like their other thin friends are eating. And you know what? They might be able to eat more than you. And it's not even just leptin that's the reason for that. Genetics have a role in our weight gain. Some people gain weight much easier than others because of genetics. Gender plays a role. Even bacteria and viruses play a role, as does age and our hormone levels. So we're all really very individual. Your dieting history, how much you've gone up and down, you've affected your leptin levels. That effect of lower leptin can last for years. It's been studied up to 6 years and might even last longer. And all of those things have a role to play. So we can never really compare ourselves to someone else. You have to take your own history and your own body type into consideration. So number one thing that people can do is awareness. And hopefully the Secret Life of Fat is a start to real awareness on all the different reasons that we gain weight. It's not all just sloth and gluttony. The second big part of the solution really is persistence. You know, your fat is fighting to come back. It is making you hungrier. It is getting you a little bit more obsessive about food. fMRI studies show that when people have lost 10% of their weight or more, they're actually much more responsive to food. And their inhibitory centers, actually the activity diminishes. So they're more responsive and have less self-control. And so you're hungrier, you have less self-control, you're more obsessive, and you really have to fight that for years. And so you have to persist. Willpower becomes a part of it. I do have a whole chapter on the psychology of dieting, you know, how to persist, how to build up that strength. Willpower is like a muscle, and you have to build it up in steps so that you can really go through years of staying on a diet to maintain a low weight. And so, you know, awareness, persistence, and then there's some things you can just be smart about. You know, there are a number of hormones that that affect fat. Insulin is talked about an awful lot, but there's also growth hormone and testosterone, hormones that bust through fat, and they decline with age. But there are exercises, there are ways of eating that actually will help some of that fat-busting hormones increase again. So just being smarter about our fat, understanding it and then taking those, you know, those steps, those kind of special steps that hopefully can help you manage it. But, you know, it's not easy, and I don't sugarcoat things in The Secret Life of Fat. This is a hard problem to grapple with.
We're talking to Sylvia Tara right now. She's a biochemist and the author of The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. And Sylvia, as part of this, that maybe we should stop being so obsessed with the amount of fat that we have. I mean, if you look at different ages, there have been times in this country where fat was seen as desirable and people tried to plump up and there was a fat man society for people who were really prosperous. Maybe the secret is just easing up and realizing that it's more a question of having a balanced mindset about body fat.
Yeah, and I think that's right. You know, fat was one time respected even in America. There was a time after the Civil War where there was poverty and destruction and food was hard to come by. And in that time, fat was really, it was cherished. There was the Fat Man's Club in the U.S. where men had to be fat enough to join. It was seen as prestige. There were columns in newspapers telling women how to gain weight, the vice columns. So it was quite the opposite of today. And, you know, it all turned around when people started gaining weight a little more easily, when food became more plentiful. And businesses got in, started selling solutions for how to lose weight, and there became this big echo chamber, and people got very self-conscious about their fat. It became a judgment. And we're still in that era a bit where fat is a judgment. And, you know, but if you really look at the science of fat and what it's important for, why we need it, there's a bigger range that's healthy than what people think. Obesity is not good. Visceral fat is not good, but nor is excessive leanness. And I discussed that quite a bit in The Secret Life of Fat. And so there are cases where people can even be fat but fit. I give the example of sumo wrestlers, and sumo wrestlers eat 5,000 calories a day. They're obese by any stretch of the imagination. Another trick that fat has, though, is that it releases another hormone called adiponectin, and adiponectin can clear triglycerides and cholesterol out of the blood and sequester it into fat where it belongs. Now, the key is that sumo wrestlers exercise 6 to 7 hours a day, and exercise promotes this release of adiponectin. And so they're actually clearing their blood of all these excess nutrients, all these excess lipids, and putting it into fat where it belongs. And so they tend to be metabolically healthy. The other thing that's important to know is not all fat is created equal. So we have visceral fat, which is that fat underneath our stomach wall, and that is the more dangerous fat that leads to heart disease and diabetes. There's also subcutaneous fat, that is the fat right under our skin, and that's the healthier deposit of fat. Sumo wrestlers actually have more subcutaneous fat. They don't have that much visceral fat, and therefore they are healthier than people who are just regular obese and have excess amounts of visceral fat. So you can be fat but fit if your fat is in the right places and you're also exercising and otherwise eating a healthy diet. What's interesting about sumo wrestlers is when they retire and they stop exercising, they do get visceral fat because they don't have as much adiponectin anymore, and their fat is now being stored not just underneath their skin but in their belly as well. They quickly become unhealthy. So, you know, it's important to know. You have to know, you know, what fat is. You have to understand it at the different levels. You have to be just about as clever as your fat is in order to be able to fight it back and keep it in check. But I do hope that The Secret Life of Fat gives people a more comprehensive understanding, and hopefully they'll even gain some respect for what their fat's doing underneath their skin that they never knew about.
Sylvia Tara is with us now. She's a biochemist and the author of the book we're talking about. It's called The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about fat? What it is, how it works, maybe how to manage it so we have the better kinds, not so much of the bad stuff. What are your thoughts? What are your questions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about body fat, why we have it, how it works, and how we can maybe make peace with it. And Sylvia Tara joins us. She's a biochemist and the author of The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how body fat works? Are you at war with your own fat, or have you made peace with it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Ruth joining us in Altoona. Ruth, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm just calling because for the last year we've changed the way we eat. We were pretty careful anyway, but we really just began to eat differently. I kind of don't like the word diet because it really is about changing lifestyle and how you eat. But we've cut out sugar very, very significantly. But we eat fat. I mean, we eat good fats, healthy fats, not unhealthy ones. But we eat natural fat, you know, things like coconut oil or olive oil we use in our food. And we've lost a lot of weight. None of us are too thin, but we also, you know, are careful not to let that happen. But we've lost a lot of extra fat, and, you know, I'm glad you just recently said the things about obesity that you said before you went to the other part of the program and then came back. Obesity is, there's just way too much of that in our country, and
Ruth, I'm going to get our guest in on that. Thank you for that call. And Ruth has changed the way she's eaten. Sounds like that was a family endeavor, cut out sugar, does eat healthy fats. And Sylvia, you were talking about there being, in the body that is, good fat and less good fat. Is there any correlation between the kinds of fat that we eat and the kinds of fat that we have in the body?
So I think not as much. I think the types of fat we have in our body, you know, it's a resultant of a number of things, not just the type of fat we're eating, but the type of food we're eating and how much we're exercising as well. And so I think cutting out sugars, it's a great start, right, to start losing fat, and sugar is tied to insulin, as we know. And when we have too much sugar, it leads to insulin sensitivity, and our bodies don't react to it as well. And so lowering that certainly leads to better health overall. There's a number of ways, though, that you really can get your fat down if you have excess amounts of that. You know, you have to think of it, again, individually. So what works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for another. One diet doesn't fit all. There are people who really have trouble staying on a no-sugar diet. It's very restrictive for them, and they tend to go off, and they don't come back. And so really consider your own life, your own biology, and your own kind of psychology for what you need. A diet has to work for you biologically. You have to be able to lose weight on it. You have to see a result. At the same time, it has to work with your lifestyle. So for people who, you know, they like a little bit of sugar, they find that they keep breaking down on some of these restrictive diets. There's other things you can do. One diet that I like and I actually use is intermittent fasting, where you just restrict the time of eating to certain hours of the day. You make sure you get about a 16-hour fast in your day. And you have a lot more latitude on what you eat when you do that. I'm one of these people who I really like a little bit of sugar every now and then. And so those kind of Atkins diets, very restrictive diets, I end up not staying on it for long. So just be tuned to yourself, to your biology, where you're responding to, and psychologically, what can you stay on for years? Because it will be a lifestyle change. It's not something you can just go on and off if you want to lose weight.
Why does a 16-hour fast work?
So when you extend the overnight fast, the thought is that you extend the release of growth hormone. Our growth hormone is actually a great fat buster, but it declines as we age. Growth hormone actually peaks in its release at night. And so if you stop, and when we eat, we actually mitigate the levels of growth hormone in our blood. And so the thought is if you fast a little bit before you go to sleep, you know, wait a little bit before you have breakfast, you're actually maintaining that level of growth hormone in your blood, which is a great fat buster. Also, when you have some periods of hunger, you release a hormone called ghrelin, which is from the stomach, and it actually helps promote the release of growth hormone as well. And so, you know, don't hate your hunger pangs too much. They actually might be leading to more, you know, growth hormone, a little bit more fat loss. And so, you know, it's not that hard to do if you stop eating, say, at 6 o'clock at night and then don't eat again until about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock the next day. You get that 16-hour fast in. And time-restrictive eating has also been shown to decrease appetite. So
So there's something about just restricting eating to certain hours and that long stretch of hunger that your body starts to adjust to that and stops craving and wanting food all the time as well. So a number of benefits for it. But again, it's not for everybody. You know, intermittent fasting is not easy, especially if you have a life where you have to eat, you know, socially quite a bit. There's a number of diets out there, and I would just urge people to know that there's other solutions. Be smart about how you tailor your diet. And once you understand fat and metabolism at a deeper level, you actually can take any diet and modify it to make it work for you. And I'm hoping some of the research I've done helps people do that.
Let's take another call. We've got Peg joining us in Rice Lake. Peg, hi.
Hi there.
What would you like to ask?
What about the body fat that's stored under the skin, which begins to decrease with old age? Is there any way to restore that fat or to keep it?
Okay. Peg, thanks for that. Sylvia.
That's a very interesting question. We do lose a subcutaneous fat as we age. And so fat actually has a trajectory in our life. We have good amounts of it as a baby, of course. We gain it as we go towards puberty. And then towards middle ages, we gain more because our hormones are declining. And then oddly, as we start to age into the 70s and beyond, our fat cells don't hold as much fat anymore. And that's just because they're weakening. They're not as strong as they used to. And when they don't hold as much fat, you actually get more lipids floating around in your blood, more fat, you know, depositing in other places. And so can you increase the amount of subcutaneous fat? Can you make fat cells stronger, really, in old age? I don't know if there's a way to do that right now. I don't believe there is. I do think that continuing to exercise into your upper years is a great benefit. And that, you know, again, there's certain exercises, especially strength-building exercise, you know, running for long bits as well. If you can run 3 miles a day or so, it releases more growth hormone again. It helps release testosterone a little bit more, which helps you build lean tissues as well, helps your metabolism stay up, and actually, you know, can help you stay a little bit more youthful longer. And so the thing to be aware of in old age is that, or older years, I should say, is that because we're not storing fat quite as well as we used to, you know, also watch what you eat quite a bit. Don't have a lot of excess lipids and sugars and things like that. Try to eat healthier because maintaining good health in older years, upper years, is actually quite, it's more of a challenge than it is, obviously, when you're in your 20s and you have your full array of hormones and lean tissue to work with.
Thanks a lot for that call, Peg. And looking down the road, Sylvia, what is the cutting edge of body fat research? Of course, I think a lot of people would just like a pill that you pop and poof, it's a lot easier to lose weight and still be healthy at the same time. What are researchers looking at?
There's so many interesting things on the horizon. I mean, one is leptin replacement for dieters. You know, so like we talked about, when we lose fat, we lose leptin. It makes us hungrier when we have lower leptin or we have a slower metabolism, and that effect lasts for years. One thing that's been researched is injecting some leptin back into people after they've lost some weight, and they find that that actually helps improve appetite. They're not seeking food as much. Also, the metabolism's a little higher, so they don't have to have that caloric penalty after you eat. It's still in research stages, probably not available for at least another decade if it ever does become available. You know, secondly, brown fat is being looked at. So brown fat is different than white fat. White fat's the fat we want to lose. Brown fat, instead of hoarding calories, actually burns calories. And so injecting brown fat into white fat is being looked at as a way possibly to lose weight later. You know, but another, I think, more practical and maybe a more imminent solution to this is going to be the individualization of diets. Some research coming out of Weizmann Institute in Israel actually shows that people react differently to foods. And so some people can eat something like chocolate or have some alcohol. They don't really get blood sugar spikes from some of these things that you would assume is going to increase blood sugar. There are other people who can't do that. They can just have, you know, a single chocolate chip and get this big blood sugar spike. And so we all respond a little bit differently with genetics, too. You know, we have different penchants for putting on weight. And so can you individualize a diet per person? And that's being looked at as well with different algorithms, people taking a genetic test, people testing their blood, you know, quite constantly to see what effect it's having, their body is having to foods. And so I think it's moving in that direction where we're learning not everyone is the same. Some people get away with eating massive amounts of calories and they're thin. Other people can, you know, eat 1,000 calories a day and still have a weight problem. And you really have to understand all those elements, you know, and tailor a diet that works for you. So exciting things out on the horizon. Some are quite far. Some are a little closer if you're really diligent about what mm-hmm. you're eating and you understand fat.
Well, Sylvia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great, thank you. It's great to be here.
Sylvia Tara is a biochemist and the author of the book, The Secret Life of Fat, The Science Behind the Body's Least Understood Organ and What It Means for You. She joined us to talk about fat and why it's more complex than you think. And you can let us know your comments about this over on the Central Time Facebook page.
A new beverage craze is sweeping the nation, or at least the online part of it. A candy shop based in Ohio has released pickle juice soda pop.
It's called Grandpa Joe's Candy Shop. They're behind the sweet and salty drink. It went viral on the internet, and don't get too excited because their first run of the product sold out really fast.
And among the first purchases of this was not me. This doesn't sound great to me. You? Pickle juice soda.
I am more open-minded than I would have been a few years ago because if you look, they're pickle-flavored potato chips now.
Which I like and makes sense.
Right, and I wouldn't have liked that. And I had them and they're delicious. Fried pickles are a big thing now. Uh-huh. I know what you're saying. This is not mixing sugar. But sure, I would try that. Maybe pickles are more versatile than we think.
I just wonder about the inspiration. Was it somebody, they finished that last pickle in the jar. They're looking at the jar of pickle juice thinking, if only it were carbonated and sweetened, I'd be all over that.
Well, wait a minute. Do you like sweet pickles?
I mean, yeah. I like dill better.
You like sweet pickles, though, and so there you go. You just puree them, put a little seltzer water in, and you can make your own pickle soda.
I won't. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that at all. You are welcome to, and you can report back to us on it.
Oh,
how about that?
I'll absolutely do this.
All right, I'm looking forward to that. I'll look for it in the future here on Central Time.